And I just, I'll very quickly, I'm sure most of you know Sherry already, but I'd like to welcome our next speaker, Sherry Deckard, who's a lecturer at UCD in Dublin. She's the author of Paradise Discourse, as well as the editor of a recent special issue of the journal Green Letters. And I'll pass over to her, and she's...
Is it coming up? No! Don't tell me that! I get these filters.
Working.
Okay, all right. In a sort of crookedy kind of way.
And she's going to be talking about commodity regimes and food regimes in Caribbean fiction.
Where's the little thing to make it big? Oh, there it is. Okay. No! Go away. Okay. So I cheated slightly here. This is a map, technically, of Latin American commodities, which I don't know if you can see very well. All the kind of, there's cacao over here, and cacao up there. And I'm going to be talking a lot about cocoa and cacao. And it has the Spanish Caribbean as well. But it's missing out on the rest of the Caribbean islands. So I apologize for that. I couldn't find a commodities map of just... the Caribbean or all of it together. But still, you can see a kind of interesting mapping here, and I've stolen the image from Erica Beckman's very interesting new book on capital fictions. Okay, so let's find my paper. I take my title today from Samuel Selvan's final peasant novel, Those Who Eat the Cascadura, which was first published in short story form in 1948 as Johnson and the Cascadura. So although it was published as a novel in 1972, it's kind of bizarre in that it's quite immature and reflects a lot of his earlier work, even though it was published much later than his earlier peasant trilogy, the kind of famous one. So there is this kind of interesting dynamic of the aesthetic, and that they're quite, I think, problematic in some ways. The novel is somewhat neglected in criticism, probably partly because its aesthetics are weaker than Selvan's other work. But what's significant about it is that it portrays Trinidad's lesser-known first commodity. Trinidad had cocoa before it had sugarcane, actually, was this the case with many of the islands. So I want to talk today about cocoa, and it diverges from, you know, the rest of Selvan's sort of exploration of sugarcane culture, and particularly the way the Indo-Trinidadian peasantry were exploring it. It's set on a British cocoa estate in Sangre Grande in the 1920s, and as I just said, cocoa was grown in Trinidad before sugar. It was imported from South America in the 17th century after tobacco collapsed due to various pressures, including competition and trade embargoes and other things. When the novel opens, however, cocoa is in its bust phase, and I'm going to be talking about booms and busts. So this is a novel that's very much showing cocoa in crisis on the island. Life on the hill country estate is portrayed as sleepier, as more peripheral than that of the coastal sugar plantations that you see in the other novels. It does demand hard labor from the descendants of indentured migrants, but it also produces a local culture around such customs as dancing the cocoa, which is described at great length in the novel. When the workers tread cacao beans with their bare feet to clean off the sticky mucilage, because they open up the pods and inside of these beans, and they had to clean off this kind of sticky goo and then lay them out to dry in the sun. And this festival usually includes drums, dancing, sometimes fertility rites to celebrate the harvest. The estate in the novel is called Sans Souci, but it's far from untroubled with the post-war Port of Spain strikes, these great post-war strikes rumbling throughout the background of the novel, and the plantation estate owner is constantly being called to kind of crucial meetings in the capital to deal with them. And this landlord, Roger, says that he's determined to hold out against the, quote, unrest and strikes that were the birth pangs of a people moving from subjugation. So he's kind of like trying to hold on to this plantation and freeze it in time. So there's a strange sense of stasis or of kind of holding everything together in the novel that's broken by the end when a hurricane pitches up. All three of the books I'm going to talk about today have hurricanes almost always signaling the end of a particular plantation cycle, often linked to unrest, political unrest, strikes by state workers, and the inauguration of new forms of socio-ecological relations. Even though I'm not going to talk about the hurricane in much depth, I thought it's important to kind of note that.
At the same time as he's dealing with all this unrest and strikes, there's a bad market that's kind of hanging over the novel. Low cocoa prices in the world market. There's declining production and, as I said, hurricane damage, which force him at the end of the book to plan an amalgamation of his plantation with that of his neighbors in order to establish a monopoly. So cartelization is an attempt to kind of shore up a declining regime. His title refers to the poem that's in front of the screen before you, horrible exoticist little ditty. And it comes from a Trinidadian myth that those who eat the small, horny-scaled cascadora fish, which is native to Trinidad and in the rivers, it's a river fish, which is traditionally prepared by Indo-Trinidadians, so not so much so by other ethnicities on the island, in a curry called cascadu. If you eat it, you're supposed to be destined to return to Trinidad. So this verse by the 1930s poet Alistair MacMillan enshrines the language with kind of full exoticist forced, describing, you know, kind of paradisal description of the island's natural beauties with romantic descriptions of the commodities and cash crops which have overdetermined its history, sugar, cocoa, the lake of pitch, and later oil. So you can see the cocoa woods with their scarlet glory juxtaposed with the waterfalls and fertile valleys, the waving sugar plantations. Oh, they're so beautiful, these plantations, how wonderful. You know, can you not wonder at this legend? So it's a very exoticist kind of dream of the foreign colonial traveler kind of who wants to return to the island. It offers what Erica Beckman calls in the Latin American context an aesthetics of export reverie, which represses the real of the extraordinary human and environmental violence, which is required to shape and rationalize nature into export crops, into cocoa woods and plantations. Yet, the poem nonetheless pairs cascadora and cocoa woods, the folk foodway versus the export commodity, and its significance signaling the kind of socio-ecological relation between plantation and vernacular foodways, which persist alongside cash crop regimes. Selvin describes in the book, and there's a whole plot point which I won't go into because it's part of this cheesy kind of romance about the inability to bridge the Indo kind of Trinidadian peasant girl and the perspective of the white planter, and they're torn asunder at the end, even though she prepares cascadu for him, he's doomed to leave the island. So, you know, it's kind of cheesy, but it's interesting as in itself it's a kind of a comment, this failed romance, the inability to suture together the kind of two different class positions or the kind of mode of production is itself a kind of commenter on the kind of export logic. But I won't go into it in great length. Anyway, Selvin describes the fish as originally a supplement to the diet of impoverished laborers on the estates in the 19th century. In pre-war days, it was eaten only by poor people in the country villages, but now it appears in the stalls of the city market and fetches a handsome price. Coarse in texture, pungent in taste, as he describes it, but a high in nutrition as an oily fish. The scaly fish is not originally an object of desire, but rather of subsistence for those who cannot afford to buy basic imported food products or meat. Cascadura begins as a food of what Lynn Marie Houston calls making do, using every part of whatever is on hand, whether it be animal or plant parts that are usually discarded, or the extraction of liquid from poisonous varieties of cassava to make cassareep seasoning for pepper pot, which is a dish that's throughout many islands of the Caribbean. It's a kind of gastronomic philosophy which is necessitated by the cash crop regimes, the plantation economies. Transformed with the additions of spices into a curry, cascadu, however, becomes desirable, a culinary articulation of terroir. Poet Roy Quabena captures this transformation in his spoken word poem Cascadura, rewriting that overturns the exoticist theme of the elite colonial foreigner who falls in love with Trinidad and supplants the export reverie with the perspective of indigenous folkways. In Quabena's poem, with its repeated refrain, curry cascadu, I really love me cascadura. Cascadu, you'll see, he sings it. It's very catchy. I can't get it out of my head. Cascadu becomes a celebration of creolized Trinidadian identity, couched in reference to both carnival and to other local foodways. I'll play you a short clip of it now, with it set to calypso music. And the video images weren't from the poet. They're actually from an anthropologist who collaborated with him called Maximilian Forte. And he says that they're meant to to kind of mediate between the colonialist perspective, the archival footage kind of with the exoticist gaze, and between a contemporary carnival perspective, which kind of represents the persona of the poet. So make it of it what you will. If I can get it, where's my little magic thingy? There we are. Okay. Stop it. It was fine. Whoops. No. Sorry. It's just the stupid security alert kind of rumbled me. Right. It was working earlier, so I'm sure it'll work now.
So though I didn't relish the mountain dew, when laced with scorpions and Santa Fe, nor tasted the caiman singly cooked for me, I did enjoy the cascadura, and yes, I wish in Trinidad to end my days.
So here's the white people. Here she's picking
Best Village Competition, Tapia Yard in St. Augustine, who say no Ramlila will be banned if I have my way. Come in Cascadia, I really love my Cascadia. See you Cascadia, I really love my Cascadia. Staring at island homes, Nelson Carrera and Shaka Shakari in dismay. Pepper sauce on the highway. Saw coconut water from the Queen's Park Savannah. Hot doubles in San Juan. Traffic in the Quasi. Mincing fresh side from Sholo, black mud in Maruga, Parang in Santa Cruz on Opino, Diwali in Palasico, a lime in the North Sky for Panorama, breadfruit oiled on with saltfish and digo, a curry cook up at Cora or Camarita.
Here's a lot of pictures of I'm going to stop you here, but you can kind of get the general gist of it. So he kind of goes through and does a kind of map of the island with all the different cultural foodways and the kind of significances they have. Okay, then I'll go back to here. So it's a very celebratory kind of creolized identity as opposed to the kind of exoticist version that you get in the other poem, or even in Selvon's, the Cascadura is this kind of failed attempt to reconcile basically contradictory class positions. In Caribbean literature, vernacular foodways are often reconstructed not merely as subsistence, but as cultural opposition to plantation. The aims of my paper today are allegedly twofold: to survey key aesthetic and thematic concerns of what might be designated the literature of cacao, and to explore how fictional representations of plantation regimes are always interweaved with references to the indigenous foods grown, caught, and consumed by workers, often on smallholder plots interweaved with estate crops or on half acres owned by peasants. What might constitute the aesthetics of literature of Cascadura in this case, or Manejo in the case of the Portuguese-Brazilian novel I'm looking at, or Blugo in the case of Merle Collins' novel Angel. My paper today is just a kind of initial foray rather than a kind of really worked out analysis of cocoa, which has been less visible in historiography. One of the recent books to come out by a kind of Cambridge historian, which is very all kind of like, if they'd only liberalized more, the plantations would have been fine and cocoa would have persisted, keeps lamenting the lack of cocoa historiography. And there's also a kind of a lack of visibility as much, I think, in kind of literary analysis of commodity regimes. seems, in comparison to those other overweening commodities, king sugar, rubber, the devil's milk, tobacco, the demon weed, etc., etc. And there's a reason, partly because there's a peculiar violence attached to those commodities. But I want to explore the ways in which actually cocoa, in many cases, does have its own violence attached to it, but also at times because it was both a peasant crop and a plantation crop. It has a contradictory history where sometimes it's much more ecologically sustainable than when it's being grown in plantation conditions. So there's contradictions in how it appears in literature, and there's contradictions in its specific history. I'll discuss fiction from three of the primary sites of cocoa production: Selva's Cascador, Merle Collins' Angel from Grenada, and Jorge Amaro's The Violent Land from Bahia in Brazil, with the idea to evoke the kind of homologies and aesthetic differences relating to the particularities of the cacao regime in each site. However, my analysis will be slightly impressionistic, dwelling some more on some texts than others due to space and time. The relationship between cash crop and foodway, between cocoa and Cascador, which is only unconsciously registered in Macmillan's poem, is made explicit in Selvin's novel and in the fiction by Collins and Amaro, all of which represent the foodways required to sustain the forms of unfree, indentured, and wage labor demanded by plantation. Collins' novel, which I'll start with, Angel, is set in Grenada, spanning the 1951 Red Sky strike. So it opens with strike. It also opens with the 1955 Hurricane Janet, which she says created new conditions by wiping out everything that existed, including killing all the kind of dying cocoa trees in order to make space to plant new ones under forest conditions rather than plantation conditions. So hurricane is indelibly tied both to ecological regime and to labor unrest. It opens, as I said, in 1951 when Gary's union burned down the cocoa estates and plantations, and it goes through to the 1979 Grenadian Marxist Revolution and the subsequent U.S. invasion in 1983. Like Selvin's novel, it opens in a period of cocoa bust, with declining prices accompanied by increases of labor resistance and signs of ecological exhaustion. When Hurricane Janet strikes in 1955, protagonist Dudsey expresses relief that the old dying trees have been swept away to make way for new saplings. Collins utilizes three generations of women, Ma Etty, her daughter Dudsey, and her grandchild Angel, to narrate the period of revolutionary history from the perspective of women's everyday experiences. While Dudsey's brother is often involved in union organization, her husband leaves her to go to the U.S. as an agricultural laborer, picking on plantations in the U.S., leaving her to feed her family on her own. Collins thus lays bare the consequences of Grenada's export economy, in which basic food imports become unaffordable when Dudsey takes her malnourished son to a patronizing doctor who commands her to feed him milk. So you can see here, the doctor told her severely that they should drink more milk. "You should eat properly," he repeated slowly. "Drink some milk." Fighting off tears of first shame, then rage, Dudsey barely refrains from punching him in the face. And she says, "I will ask him where the hell I must get the money. He think milk is nutmeg, on which tree I could find it." The idea that, you know, milk is an import crop, nutmeg is a cash crop that is exported. She can't buy milk, she can't afford to purchase it. Throughout the novel, when cocoa prices plummet and strikes prevent work, women and their families turn to their plots to survive, growing yam and peas, two grain ublugo, which is a plantain variety that isn't exported, unlike bananas. It's much less sweet, it's starchier, it has a higher nutritional content. They plant corn, and they cultivate a little nutmeg on their plants in order to sell in the nutmeg pool for cash. The nutmeg pool sounded like it was a great idea. It was a co-op that all the workers could come to, but it wasn't actually cooperative in the sense that there was only one representative for all the workers on the whole island of the actual kind of laborers and pickers in the co-op, and it was owned by the nutmeg exporters and producers, so they basically kept the prices very, very low. So it sounds like a kind of a positive thing, a co-op, but actually it was something which was used also to kind of an exploitative way. Dudsey sells nutmeg, drinks soursop leaf tea and spice tea. and gardens her acre, exclaiming, "Thank the Lord for the little piece of land and for the strength I have so that I can still plant the 2 grain of peas and corn, else I don't know how I would make out." Even then, she is finally forced down to the cocoa estates as a wage laborer, quote, carrying the heavy cocoa basket and feeling the sticky cocoa sweat mix with hers, tying the cloth tight below her belly to keep the womb in place, and earns the condemnation of her mother, who makes a class distinction between poor, proud peasant farmers on their plots and who own a tiny bit of land because of 19th century land laws that redistributed land after the emancipation of the slaves. She makes a distinction between peasant farmers and the estate wage laborers, saying, "Now you under cocoa, we was never this kind of people." So under cocoa is a kind of a sign of, it's pejorative, that you have to go and work on the plantation estate. You don't have the ability to be self-sufficient. In an interview, Merle Collins comments that the milk episode is intended to expose the dynamics of the export dependency. How much what happens in the country and how the country organizes itself is also for outside. I want Dudesy to be a character through whom people end up seeing how these people supply raw material for the outside world. So every part of her daily, everyday, ordinary experiences is determined by the logic of export, by the logic of cocoa and nutmeg prices, the price of import crops. World market volatility dictates local reality, and the novel is intensely price conscious, as the quote below, as when union organizer Regal explains, "The government saying that cocoa price fall, so they go have to reduce estate workers' pay. When cocoa price fall, everybody knowing. But you ever hear them saying Ting's food, cocoa price really high, so we go give laborers a big raise?" Yeah, so, you know, the prices go up, nobody makes any more money. But when they go down, they start appropriating their land or paying them less. Dudesy's cousin Maymay, lacking a plot, is forced to pick nutmeg and to sharecrop the cocoa estate for the absentee landlord, planting her garden among the trees. So this was quite a common practice, that they would plant gardens in amongst the cocoa trees, and they would supposed to be harvesting both the cocoa shade, which are shade trees, and also growing their own food in there. She plants her garden only to have the planter seize the land. And she says, "Then after you work your piece of ground, put all your labor in it, when the cocoa they ask you to plant in between well in its growth now, they taking away the piece of land from you and give you a new pace to the same thing. So 5 to 6 years later, when cocoa in that first piece of ground, you work in full bearing, you harvesting it for the boss for 1 shilling and 6 pence a day." So incredibly low prices, but also the temporality of the cocoa, how long it takes to grow crops, and the way that they're being cycled. The interaction between foodways and export is more prominent in Collins and Selvin than in Amadou, whose novel is more masculinist in its focus on male labor and male authority. The only visible women's work in the novel I'm about to discuss, The Violent Land, is prostitution, rather than the feminist depiction of domestic labor and the meaning that accrues from agricultural garden labor in Collins. A key component of The Violent Land's divergence also lies in the profound differences in class constitution and cocoa cultivation in the two novels. In Violent Land, we see the characteristics of the Bahian history of cacao as an extensive estate crop farmed by various forms of slave, coerced, indentured, and exploited labor. Whereas in Merle Collins' Angel, we see the kind of exceptional and different history. It's a very mixed history in Grenada of cocoa as both a peasant commodity grown on small half acres or acre plots and as a plantation commodity grown on estates with absentee, for the most part, white landlords by sharecroppers. In Bahia, smallholder farmers had their land seized violently or were actually physically murdered by planters seeking to amalgamate larger and larger estates. And the focus of the novel is therefore not on a peasant economy, but the bloody period of primitive accumulation in which the large plantation systems were constructed. Oh, I already have it there. An old Afro-Brazilian descendant of slaves warns a group of young, mixed-race, would-be sharecroppers that the so-called gold rush, and the cacao rush is described over and over again as a gold rush. They say cacao is gold. He described it as hollow. He says their dreams of wealth will only be met with indentured servitude as they are transformed into debt peons by the plantation stores. Quote, "Down here, everybody's in debt. No one has anything coming to him now. So everything they buy in order to go and actually work comes out of debt, which is ever getting higher, so they're never actually able to buy their way out. They can never send money back to their families that they have left behind in the coast in the north, and they are never able to leave because they're basically compelled labor. Similarly, the ship captain who brings laborers to the interior guiltily muses that he feels like a captain of one of those slavers in the old days that brought blacks over to sell them as slaves. And the novel draws again and again a connection between the past history of slavery in other contexts, particularly sugar, and the kind of use of compelled labor in the case of cocoa plantation. However, throughout the novel, we see millet and manihoe is a kind of cassava, which is kind of indigenous to Brazil, sustain cacao workers throughout the novel. They subsist on the drought-resistant grain and cassava they manage to grow in small plots or to buy on credit from plantation stores, but they don't drink the cocoa they produce. They don't drink the cash crop, even though it's allegedly has medicinal, nutritional kind of qualities in the 1920s. For Antonio Victor, a disillusioned migrant, plantation work is experienced as dehumanizing, grueling labor that makes him yearn nostalgically for the small plot of land he had left behind on the coast. Quote, the work was heavy, a great deal heavier than it had been in the little millet plot that he had cultivated with his brothers before coming to these lands in the south. The sun began beating down on the bare backs of Antonio Victor and the other workers, especially those who had come down with him from Bahia and were not used to it. Their feet would sink into the mire, the viscous, molten cacao would stick to them, caught on the sole of his feet and growing greater in bulk all the time, like some weird kind of shoe. Images of this cacao slime, as it's referred to throughout the novel, appear repeatedly, clinging to the bodies of exhausted workers, weighing them down, sucking out their energy. No carnivalesque scenes of dancing the cocoa in this novel. When Antonio was given the chance to become a capanga, a bodyguard assassin for the estate owner, he is quick to abandon sharecropping for the much more profitable profession. One question around the literature of cocoa might be whether its aesthetics differ from those of sugar, whether sugar is more extreme in its social and ecological violence, and therefore its fetishism as registered in literature. Sugar and cocoa, those two stimulants, have a symbiotic history. Seeking to fashion cacao into a commodity to be exploited commercially in the Baroque European markets, the Spanish famously added sugar to what was an unsweetened, cold chocolate beverage, which had been first introduced by Montezuma to Cortes. And interestingly, the Spanish also learned about plantations from the Aztecs because they had vast cocoa plantations. The conquistadors have many accounts of seeing these huge, kind of quite rationalized plantations of growing cocoa, because cocoa was used as, beans were used as a mode of currency by many of the Mayan and the Olmec Indians, and it had a huge kind of ritual and cultural significance within their society. But it's interesting that plantation actually emerges quite early on. Cocoa cultivation developed a reciprocal relationship with sugar plantation, accentuated by the fact that cacao is less bulky than sugar, and as a tree crop can be grown in hilly, mountainous, more peripheral country, and thus does not compete spatially with the flat coastal land area that is required for cane sugar. As a result, it has been periodically significant, as I've said, as an estate and a peasant commodity, and as we've seen in the contrasting cases of Granada and Brazil. Now, that can work both ways. If it grows in the hilly country and it's being grown, as I'll talk about, under shade, in which case much of the tree canopy above the trees remains, so it's more biodiverse, it's more sustainable, it can last for up to 50 years of plantation. But if it's being grown under shade, which is much more profitable in the short term, it's much less sustainable, and it means that not only are you deforesting all the coast for sugarcane plantation, you're also deforesting the hilly mountainous regions which are unsuitable for cane in order to make short profits off of cocoa. So depending on the history, it actually sometimes worsened ecological damage caused by deforestation because of the two crops often being grown either simultaneously or in turns. In many islands, cocoa and sugar plantation took turns seesawing as world market prices cyclically rise and fall. In St. Lucia and Grenada, for instance, cocoa cultivation accelerated at the same time as sugar prices fell in the 19th century. and cocoa entirely displaced sugar in the Bahia region of Brazil during the great cacao price boom of the 1890s and the subsequent cacao rush of the 1920s, as it's called. I'm using their terms. When Bahia evolved into one of the world's leading cacao production zones. Conversely, extensive sugar plantation frequently replaced cacao after it succumbed to ecological exhaustion. So obviously, Haiti is a famous case of this. The Spanish colonies of Jamaica, Cuba, Hispaniola, where cacao disappeared from the extensive cocoa walks after they were decimated by blasts. In other words, there was mass die-offs of the cocoa plantations because of blight, disease, hurricane, and sun exposure, so the kind of collapse of the regime. And it was subsequently replaced by the sugar economy, which would dominate those islands' histories and cause such kind of catastrophic environmental violence. In Bahia, at least, cocoa has at least as violent a history as sugar in terms of human enslavement and dispossession. As Timothy Walker observes, compelled, coerced, and exploited human labor played a role in the gathering and processing of cacao at every stage of Brazilian cacao production throughout history. Whether, quote, wild cacao pods were collected in the Amerindian bush by Native Americans, or later taken from trees marshaled into neat plantation rows by Africans or natives in Bahia, or later by sharecroppers. In the fiction of Collins and Amado, cocoa plantation, particularly cocoa under sun, produces noticeably violent affects, shame, anger, exhaustion, desperation. Often realized in the realist aesthetic effects, descriptions of the grueling nature of the labor, often concentrating in the slime or stickiness of cacao as akin to an uncanny bodily emission. The dominant tendency of social realism in both novels, and they have quite a political commitment to social realism in their respective socialist and communist politics, repeatedly erupts into irrealism at moments when inscribing the cyclical logic of crisis of the cocoa regime, or in trying to give voice to the dispossessions and enslavements related to commodity regimes in past history. I want to turn now to a more in-depth examination of the cyclical logic of the cash crop regime of cacao as an ecological regime. As defined with environmental historian Jason W. Moore's theory of the capitalist world ecology, eco-regimes are those relatively durable patterns of class structure, technological innovation, and the development of productive forces that have sustained and propelled successive phases of world accumulation. Because plunder exhausts the non-commodified relationships that allow capital accumulation to proceed, capitalism is always in search of what Moore calls commodity frontiers for extraction and appropriation. According to his studies of plantation monocultures in the Caribbean, the rapid appropriation of commodity frontiers and cash crops such as sugar undermines the socio-ecological conditions of profitability, typically within 50 to 75 years in any given region, encountering not only biophysical limits such as soil exhaustion, blight, or superweed effects, the blasts that kind of destroy Jamaican cocoa landscape, but also the kind of scarcities which emerge, the intertwining of resistances from laboring classes, landscape changes, and market flux. So prices, strikes, uprising, and kind of ecological transformations of landscape are all specific bundles of relations between humans and the rest of nature, specific forms of oikos. When commodity regimes are exhausted and no longer able to produce ever greater surpluses, thus failing to maintain the conditions of accumulation, they encounter what Moore calls, after Marx, the metabolic rift. It is then that the ecological revolution in socio-ecological relations occur, characterized by the extension of exploitation to new geographies, the extraction of new commodities, and the intensification of existing forms of extraction and production of new technologies and social nature relations. And Mike has also provided Caribbean Studies with a kind of powerful world ecological model for comparative study of commodity regimes, particularly the monocultures arising from plantation, where literary texts register the domination of local societies by specific commodities. The cyclical rise and fall of commodity chains enables a comparative approach that stresses periodicity and geographical comparability of the registration of commodity chains across world ecological literature. So you can compare the world historical movement of commodities, and we could actually look at the world historical movement of cocoa from Central America, to the Caribbean, to South America, to the Lusophone Islands off the coast of West Africa, to the Gold Coast and the Ivory Coast, and then over to Indonesia and then to Malaysia. So you can actually see it turning up and moving geographically. Within literary texts, registrations of cyclical regimes, differences in the registration of the periodicity of these cycles could be more finely distinguished between the ecological revolution, the moment combining the exhaustion of the previous regime, the kind of bust, with the radical reorganization of socio-ecological unities, which often has a cultural expression, and the ecological regime, when socio-ecological relations become more consolidated and kind of congeal into a kind of stability. Over 400 years of capitalist cultivation, as I said, cocoa production migrated dramatically eastwards. And in the 20th century in particular, it migrated relentlessly eastwards to West Africa and then Malaysia and Indonesia. And I just wanted to kind of, I wanted to kind of just show this right here. You can see these kind of, the points and the peaks here. These are like, the boom and then the bust. And again, you see these things. And as soon as you have one in one place, so Brazil goes up. And it, there's actually an earlier peak in Brazil back here that I don't have. I should have made a graph rather than borrowing one. There's one back in the 1920s and there's one back in the 1890s. So it goes like this, and then it starts declining when you have this insane spike of Indonesia because they start using incredibly exploitative methods of cocoa cultivation coinciding with a price in chocolate prices going up. So you have a new boom. Likewise, you see Malaysia's little spike in decline at the same time as Indonesia's going up. So these things are always being geographically relocated somewhere else. And I'll talk about this one in a minute. The reason that you have these massive geographical shifts is because they're driven by cyclical ecological crises, compounded by price volatility in the world market. Cacao as a crop is distinguished by its voracious appetite for virgin forests and its high so-called forest rent, which is greater than that of any other tropical tree crop. It was first cultivated as an understory forest species, a shade tree, which evolved in the Amazons, growing under higher trees which provided vital protection from the scorching sun. Pioneers cultivators benefited by plundering the seemingly free gifts of nature tearing down these existing forests and then planting in fertile soils that were enriched by the ashes of burned vegetation as they cleared out the forest to plant exogenous seedlings. At the same time as they sold the timber to offset the cost of clearing and labor. So again, deforestation. Newly planted cacao trees grow to maturity swiftly in 5 years, and farms therefore become productive and profitable very quickly, with high yields for new plants because they're sucking up all these nutrients out of the soil. Planters found that exposing the trees to sun would cut down and cutting down forests and shade trees would dramatically increase their short-term yields and profits and enable them to take advantage of kind of like booms in the kind of the world prices of cocoa, of chocolate. However, when you plant cocoa not under shade but under sun, it causes severe physiological stress. It shortens the life expectancy of cacao trees from 50 or more years to 20 years. So actually you take that 50 to 75 year cycle of commodity regimes and you like more than have it. So it's an incredibly violent and cyclical crisis comes up again and again. It causes their yield to decline over time. The monoculture agroforests succumb to pests such as pod rot, witch's broom, Monilia roveri, and soil exhaustion because very rarely are fertilizers used. Cocoa is extremely vulnerable to the species-area relationship. The larger the cultivated area, the larger the number of species which feed on the crop. Mature trees need more tending chemicals and fertilizer to keep producing. And rather than face huge infusions of labor and capital to replant resistant varieties in declining cacao estates, most planters choose to expand to new areas when their own states decline. Thus, one colonial historian describes cacao plantation in Bahia in the earlier 20th century as notably extensive in exploitation. When yields decline, the older plantations are abandoned and new ones are set out on virgin soils. Here is speculative and destructive economy at its worst, one that is bringing temporary and unstable activity to Ilhéus and Salvador. In short, the land for the cacao zone capitalist class terrible gender politics here, is to be raped like a woman of easy life rather than cherished like a wife. And that kind of dodgy kind of rape and prostitution and domestic wife aesthetic actually turns up quite a lot in The Violent Land. There's a particular, you know, that kind of feminization. And just to go back to this little land here, here you see basically what this chart is, again, only from the last kind of half of the 20th century rather than earlier, because the statistics are less good. But huge amount of land converted to cacao, but only a much flatter line continues to be cultivated. So they're constantly converting it. It declines, the profits go, they abandon it, then they chop down new rainforests, cultivate more. So there's a huge kind of disparity. Those two lines don't match. Cultivation doesn't match with what's being kind of chopped down. And here, this next slide is the kind of boom-bust cycle. So as each migration of cocoa production is driven by the availability of new forest land with its free, quote-unquote, cost and higher income per unit of labor and the exhaustion of the existing forest. As W.G. Clarence Smith argues, cocoa cultivation is a wasting asset, rather like mining, and the cocoa frontier is driven restlessly along, jumping huge distances from one continent to another. While cocoa under shade and forest garden cocoa can be species rich, sustainable for longer, and less ecologically destructive than other uses of agricultural land, such as sugar, cocoa under sun radically reduces biodiversity and accelerates rainforest deforestation. And here again, you see the kind of the classic phases of this particular boom and bust cycle, which is a kind of an inevitable logic. Cocoa planters frequently internalize the logic of boom and bust and adopt a speculative outlook, pursuing land use policies that produce short-term profits to capitalize on the rise of prices in the world market rather than seeking small but steady yields over a longer period of time based on long-term infrastructural investments in agricultural production and the practice of more sustainable farming. As with sugar, the rush to cultivate virgin forests when the prices are high only intensifies price volatility and the oscillation between boom, bust, since production costs rise at the very same time as yields decrease. The social and ecological violence of cacao boom-bust cycles is intensified by the shorter temporality, as I've said, of the cycles in which the exhaustion can occur in as little as 20 years. Observing the cyclical repetition of cocoa crises from Latin America and the Caribbean to West Africa, then Indonesia, then Malaysia, historian François Rouff laments l'aspect tragique de la répétition apparente de l'histoire cacaoyère, so the kind of tragic aspect of repetition that keeps happening over and over again, and he says it's a malediction of the Golden Age. This myth of the Golden Age is actually a curse. The cocoa curse and the tragic aspects of the boom-bust are borne out in the cultural production linked to cacao regimes, as I want to explore in my final section, and you've been very good sticking with me as you all sink into the heat and the sleepiness of after lunch. Concentrating on Amanu's The Violent Land, whose aesthetic intermingling social realism and spectral irrealism demonstrates the logic of crisis most powerfully, even though the Selvin and Collins texts also have examples I just don't have time to discuss. Michel Rolf Trouillot observes that the sugar export economy in colonial Haiti was not only the primary source of revenue, but produced, quote, a social culture, the socially drawn monopoly to subject to its refraction all other commodities and human beings themselves. Socially selected, socially identified, it became the principle around which human life was organized. Towns were built because of its proximity. Time was marked by its harvest. Status was linked to its possession. And Mike has argued that the schizoid logic of boom-bust, the subordination to the price volatility of the world market, and the magical fetishism of sugar culture, all manifest in Caribbean literature through an aesthetics he has called saccharine irrealism, characterized by elements of the irreal, the disjunctive, the delirious, and the personification of King Sugar as an autonomous social agent. And I want to kind of argue here that a similar aesthetic of cacao irrealism emerges in The Violent Land, which chronicles the emergence of the Bahia civilization organized around cacao. The 1943 novel is part of Amaru's so-called cocoa cycle, which charts the boom and bust phases of cacao in the southern Bahia province of northern Brazil. And sometimes this fiction is dismissed as being either too political or being too provincial, being regionalist, being about only a region. But I think the kind of point that Erica Beckman makes, that it's in the regions, it's in the peripheries, it's in the places where the plantations are being grown and the crops that are being produced, that are, these are the actual crucibles of modernity. modernity. This is the extreme violence. So, you know, it's actually kind of it's wrong to dismiss them as being only provincial novels as opposed to actually integral to the kind of history of Brazil in the 19th century. Violent Land, which its actual kind of real Brazilian title translates as Endless Lands, not Violent Land, retrospectively describes the initial rush during the 1920s boom, charting the violence of a primitive accumulation as the forest is felled, land is grabbed, and monopolies are formed by what he calls throughout the book colonels. They're not actually colonels, they dub themselves this. They're basically cocoa robber barons, who employ jagunços, hired guns, and assassins to shoot smallholders and seize their land in their quest to amass the largest plantations. As this extraordinary 1945 preface, Blood Fertilized These Lands, Amadou explains that while other novels in his cocoa cycle, such as Cacao, The Golden Harvest, Gabriella, Clove, and Cinnamon, told of the later stages of cocoa civilization, the growth of the cities, the twilight of the colonels, the appearance of the urban bourgeoisie and the rural proletariat, The Violent Land narrated the inauguration of the regime, the thrust into the forest when men struggled with one another as enemies, the epic of the cacao kernels for whom life had no value. This is the moment of ecological revolution, the moment of primitive accumulation, accumulation by dispossession, famously described by Marx as a history written in letters of blood and fire. And in the preface, Amadou imagines this revolution as producing not only a reorganization of land and social relations, but a whole literature whose aesthetic is suffused with blood, the violence and fetishism of the commodity. He says very little time was required, 50 years at most, for the cacao trees to come to maturity, to bear fruit, for the plantations to grow, for the living conditions and economy of an immense area to change. And it is curious to realize how in such a brief period, a civilization and a culture grew up out of so much spilled blood. Cacao also produced a literature, a genre with its own well-defined characteristics, its own unmistakable brand born of cacao, bearing a certain labor of blood in its pages, a bitter aftertaste of death. It is the literature of cacao, a product of the cacao civilization, its finest product. So here is the aesthetics is directly suffused with the blood and the labor and the environmental destruction that has produced it. The passage, like the novel, is acutely attuned to the temporality of the cacao regime, the maximum of 50 years until maturity, the sense of cacao culture as organic emergence from socio-ecological organization around monopoly. Blood saturates the entire aesthetic of the novel, from the opening pages which describe the blood-red moon which appears above the heads of the planters and estate workers sailing down into the interior and leaving a bloody wake in the sky behind them, thus heralding the incipient violence of the ecological revolution, to the very last lines of the novel, in which the plantation newly planted in felled forest bears its first harvest. It ordinarily takes 5 years for cacao trees to bear their first fruit, but those that were planted on the Zacaro Grande tract began budding at the end of the third year and were yielding fruit the year following. Nothing of this kind had ever been seen before, for this was the best land in the world for the planting of cacao, a land fertilized with human blood. This Gothic image of fecundity emerging from human death is characteristic of the tendency towards catachresis and eco-Gothic and eco-phobic imagery throughout the novel, the aesthetic of cacao irrealism. This irrealism is most pronounced in the early chapters of the book at the start of the ecological revolution and grows less frequent as the novel progresses and the regime solidifies. The language becomes more rational. The conflict between the rubber barons moves from the physical sphere of violent murder towards legal battles over property title. The sphere of social life becomes rationalized and the growing town is said to be progressing and modernizing. The opening chapter, however, is full of incantations, repetitions, its characters speaking in circles round and round the monoculture, full of the delirium of the gold rush, the fantasies of boom wealth, which infect every class, from would-be estate laborers to planters to speculators. A traveling salesman lauds the gold which grows in that land and the cowbell tree. A planter boasts, cacao is a new crop, but the land there is the best in the world for it. The yield is all that anybody could ask. I wouldn't trade it for coffee, not even for sugar. Cacao is gold, Captain. As the conversations circle around, quote, the one eternal theme, land, money, cacao, death, the chapter recycles the same images over and over, its circular aesthetics mirroring the characters' inability to imagine a future, a bust beyond the boom, a reality behind the export reverie. Yet the export reel manifests in spectral apparitions and outbreaks of irrealism, which signal the emptiness of the gold rush fantasy and the violence of primitive accumulation. In the second chapter, The Forest, an extraordinary extended passage of irrealist catachresis performs a virtuosic series of shifts between different epistemes, mediating the conflict of capital and the archaic. It begins with prelapsarian description of the forest as an ecosystem functioning in full complexity, independent of humans. Owls hooted by the yellow light of the moon and the night of calms. Their cries were not forebodings of evil, for men had not yet come to the giant wood. Innumerable species of snakes glided noiselessly amongst the dried leaves, and jaguars yowled frightfully those nights when they were in rut. So, you know, they're not yelling because they're vicious, they're yelling because they're horny. They're like, you know, and the owls aren't hooting because they're evil, they're howling, they're hooting because they're owls. So it's kind of interesting. The sleeping forest is not a reservoir of terror, but rather of biodiversity. The shift to ecophobia does not occur until the next paragraph, in which a line of labor with sighs over their shoulder, tasked with clearing the growth, enter the untouched tract. I'll just read part of it because it's a very long, it's a kind of extraordinary chapter. Night came, bringing with it black clouds and a great big storm, another kind of tempest, heavy with June rains, and for the first time the owl's hoot was an augury of woe. And as the tempest fell, ghostly forms awoke. The werewolf and the goblin, the padre Shimo, the fire-breathing ox, the boy Tata. They were no longer conscious of the howling of the jaguar. Now it was the ugly cry of the werewolf, a creature half wolf, half man, with enormous claws and crazed by a mother's curse. The sinister goblin dance of the capora on its one leg with its one arm as it laughed from a face that was cloven in two. The sudden apparition of these specters is significant on multiple levels. On one hand, the monsters represent the return of the repressed. The Amerindian peoples who inhabited Lower Bahia are strangely absent from most of the novel, referred to only in passing when the Maroon witch doctor, it's the bad translation there, I don't think that's the word that Amado uses, Jeremias, who fled slavery for the forest, says he had seen the white men draw near this forest, he had seen other forests felled, he had seen the Indians flee to take refuge at a safer distance, he had witnessed the sprouting of the first cacao shoots, he had seen how the plantations were formed. Michael Taussig has argued that La Vorhine, Jose Eustacio Rivera's hallucinatory novel about the rubber boom in the Amazonian basin, is problematic because it displaces the violence perpetuated against indigenous peoples onto a set of white characters, white laborers. And something is true of this novel, where the dispossession and murder of Amerindians from the allegedly virgin forest, which the cocoa barons set out to conquer, is missing from the narrative. Instead, the novel concentrates on the violence of competition, land grabbing from peasants and smallholders, and the brutality of plantation labor. The blood that soaks the soil is that of white men, mulattoes, and descendants of slaves, not that of Amerindians. Yet the forest specters call up the residual, projecting the men's fear and guilt over what has been lost onto the landscape around them. In Amerindian myth, the boy Tata, or giant fire snake with fiery eyes that blind, crawls forth against loggers, protecting the jungle. The Lobi Somen, or werewolf, originated as a figure of legend in Guarani myth, one of the seven cursed children of Tau and Karana, a creature who devours death and decays. It's kind of like, you know, performs the, you know, quite useful function of eating up decaying things, you know. So it's a figure of fear, but also of ecological significance. But in mixing with the imported legend of the European werewolf, the Lobi Somen came to mean a half-man, half-dog-like creature, a version of a kind of were-jaguar. The Kapur, the tiny red goblin who rides a pig, originally derived from Tupi legends, but the term came to be used to refer to wild, unassimilated Indians who continued to dwell in the forest, thus differentiating them pejoratively from the civilized Indians who settled on the missions. In its spectral manifestation, the capoeira chases hunters who venture into the forest. These, then, are all ecophobic and quite racialized specters of nature's revenge against the incipient destruction of the rainforest, like the destruction of Amerindian culture before. At the height of the men's terror, however, there was an epistemological shift in which they suddenly perceived the forest not as monstrous, but as divine, inhabited by spirits. The trees are full of spirits. So I was thinking of you talking about the Loas in Haiti. And they cry out, "The forest, it is not a mystery, it is not a danger, a menace, it is a god." They throw down their axes, hand size and size, and attempt to retreat backwards alongside the highway of cacao that they have forged. However, it shifts again. They are forced onward by gunpoint by the Colonel Planter, and the narration switches to Badarose, who is the name of the planter, coldly rational episteme. Quote, "All he could see was that black earth, the best in the world for the planting of cacao. Before him, he saw no longer a forest shot with lightning gleam, full of weird sounds, locked in the mystery of his age-old trunks, a habitation for the fiercest of animal and unearthly apparitions. What he saw was a cultivated field of cacao trees, trees in regularly planted rows, laden with their golden fruit, the ripe yellow chocolate nuts. So no fear, no sacral awe or reverence for him. Instead of this ecological sublime, his fantasy is that of the extreme rationalization of nature, the plantation with its rigid organization around a single commodity, which can be produced only through brutality, debt peonage, murder, slavery, indenture, wage labor, dispossession, deforestation. In this light, it is the rationalized irrationality of capital accumulation that is the true horror of the passage, the specter more material than any of the men's hallucinations. Indeed, the fever victim who cries out, one of the men has been bit by a monkey, he's got a terrible black fever, and he keeps screaming, "It's the werewolf!" And the last time he screams it, Yuka is standing in front of him, and he's looking up into the planter's face, who is pointing a gun at his head. So Yuka, the planter, is the werewolf. The hybridized lobisomen takes on European mythic dimensions precisely in order to signify capital's rapacity as it devours new spaces from the kind of regulator of decay and of kind of a sustained a kind of balance in the ecosystem to sheer rapacity, sheer devouring. The insatiable werewolf's hunger is that of the robber barons. The planter is the true monster in the forest. His planter fantasy, however, is opposed at the very end of the chapter by the prophetic vision of the candomblé man Jeremias, the forest healer who practices a syncretic religion, mingling the African orishas with the forest gods of the Amerindians, from whom he had, quote, learned the secrets of medicinal herbs. Having already witnessed slavery, cane plantation, and the aboriginal dispossession, Jeremias is possessed by an apocalyptic prophecy of the forest transformation into cacao estate. Quote, "He could see the men with their axes and their pruning knives completing the work of the flame, stripping the earth, laying it bare, digging up even the deepest roots of the tree. He saw the cacao tree springing up, and a tremendous hatred took possession of him. In his death agony, Jeremias unleashes a savage Jeremiah, calling on the African orishas and on Exu and the devil himself to curse the planters. He says, for each tree, and I'm only going to read part of this for that, for each sapling that they fell, a man shall be felled. Human flesh shall be the fertilizer that they spread for their cacao shoots, and every shrub shall be watered with their blood." So he's imagining a kind of spirit battle. But, you know, it doesn't pan out. Everything gets chopped down. The chapter concludes with his death, the passing of a way of life, the passing of the archaic, of the residual of history. Henceforth, Gothic spectral and irrealist imagery becomes less frequent in the novel. The perspective is given over to the two planter families, whose competition for the forest will unleash the very bloodbath between white men that Jeremias predicts. Violence through the eyes of the colonels, whether the environmental violence of plantation or the social violence of murder and exploited labor, is wholly rational. Colonel Horacio, hearing rumors amongst his workers that he keeps the devil under his bed, imprisoned in a bottle, merely laughs and repeats the story to the rest of the workers to reform his his authority and virility. Cacao irrealism lessens as the revolution is accomplished and the commodity regime begins to congeal into new unities. The chapter following is fittingly entitled The Birth of the Cities. Like sugar in Trouillot's description of Haiti, cacao becomes the principle around all of which human life is organizing, raising towns, ports, houses seemingly out of thin air. And there's a passage that says, the shrub that really influenced life was the cacao tree, even though not a single one was to be seen inside the city itself. It's everywhere, yet invisible. Behind every business deal that was made, every house that went up, every shot fired in the street, it was there. There was no conversation in which the word cacao did not play an essential part. Over warehouses, railroad trains, ships' holds, wagons, and citizenry, there hovered ever the odor of chocolate, which is the odor of dried cacao. The commodity around which the whole of social ecological relations is organized in this monoculture is paradoxically invisible and ubiquitous. Cacao is personified as an actor, a monoculture sweeping all before it, supplanting the lifeways, foodways, infrastructure, and technology of earlier commodity regimes with its own. Quote, the cacao did not only did away with the rum stills, the small sugar plantations, and the coffee groves, it even invaded the forest. And I'll end now with the kind of concluding words of lawyer Rue in the last pages of the novel. The lawyer whose manipulation of property titles has enabled one robber baron, Colonel Horacio, to triumph over the other planters and seize the largest tract of virgin rainforest, cynically observes the arrival of the city's new bishop. You know, they're really a civilization now if they have a bishop. In this land, my son, a cacao grove produces railroads, assassins, legal ousters, townhouses, cafes, schools, theaters, even a bishop. Cacao, my son, is everything, to which we might add even a literature, even an aesthetic. All right, thank you. Thank you for bearing through.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry, for that really wide-ranging talk. We've got sort of 5 minutes or so for a few questions before we have a quick coffee break. So has anyone got any questions or comments? Well, I will take the opportunity to. I was fascinated by what you were saying about cacao, and I mean it's a brilliant kind of, you gave a brilliant analysis of its appearance in those kind of the three areas. I mean, one thing that struck me is how similar it is to rubber, both in terms of not just in terms of the kind of the cycle of the commodity regime, but also the ways in which you kind of the ambivalent coding of it, right? That it can be this, unlike sugar, which just tends to be the kind of violent king sugar,
and that's it, just
yeah. Whereas cacao can be, you mentioned, not just the kind of the plantation, the violent land, but also it can get recoded as kind of a peasant crop, as
cocoa gardens,
and as subsistence. There's rubber has a similar thing, where it's got the devil's milk, it's this terrible kind of red rubber, absolutely violent. But it can also, there's the whole idea, especially recently, of green rubber, that it's a peasant crop, that that it can be kind of sustainable, and for similar reasons, that it originally flourished in the forests, kind of entangled with lots of other crops.
Yeah, and people are saying, oh, let's create these carbon agroforests that trap carbon and they're more biodiverse, etc., and grow cocoa, but
So about my question, which is kind of around that kind of the ambivalence of the discourse and whether they're especially kind of literature from those regions that are kind of registering it as a sort of plantation crop, whether you've looked at that kind of other stream of literature and then how it figures in terms of the aesthetics when it is the kind of the peasant crop.
I think when it's the plantation crop, it's much more violent. I mean, absolutely. And there's much more of this kind of crazy irrealism associated with just things being swept through, in the same way that with rubber novels, the vortex, the devouring jungle, the devouring mouth of rubber that's just killing people and it's bloody. I think you see that in the places that have that much more violent history. But even like in the Collins novel, there are all these spirits and things, but they're mostly associated with sugar, interestingly. Every time Angel walks through down past what they call everything in the novel under the cocoa, all the bushes referred to as the cocoa. And Merle Collins says at one point, you know, it's a marker of how much cocoa has determined the life of this island, that even though half the time the cocoa isn't cocoa, it's nutmeg or it's mango or it's these other tree crops, everything's the cocoa. But when Angel's walking through the bush and she's kind of afraid, and she's walking through the darkness trying to get home to her mother, and she's always afraid to go past this millstone by the corner of the river, it's because it's an abandoned sugar mill. It's because it's the site of slavery, and that's where the spirits and where she thinks she has dreams of this kind of ghostly white woman, a pale ghost coming out to haunt her, where she's afraid of the various kind of apparitions that might come and suck out her life. So it's very much more the violence of that, although there are kind of moments where the Coco estate is described that way, but partly in that novel because the revolution runs through it and it starts with strikes. Coco isn't so much about violence because they're contesting it, they're combating it, and because when they are growing it, you know, they tend to be growing it on plots versus, you know, I quoted the cousin May May character who doesn't grow it in that way, and she's associated with more violence. So the aesthetic is much more, it's much more ambivalent in that way, and I think that's kind of true. I was even looking at Toni Morrison's Tar Baby, which I don't think a lot of people talk about, but that's also a book all about chocolate and this kind of imagined possibly Martinique version. It's called Dominique or something in the book. And there, it's again, there are the moments of kind of strangeness in the text when it's more referring to plantation and slavery as opposed to different relations where it's actually much more mediated. But to be honest, like, I need to keep working this through because I think it's quite different in different things. Even in The Color of Forgetting, which is Merle Collins' other book, there's more, I would say, irrealism in that, partly because it's not so concerned with charting a kind of history from below and a kind of peasant history, so it's more the violence surfacing in that way. But it's something I had to keep kind of working through, to be honest. But I definitely think there's a kind of two different kind of semiotics that have to do with it, the completely different histories of it and how it's grown. So, Kirsten and I saw cocoa and coffee being grown under shade when we were in Puerto Rico, and it was like totally cool looking as opposed to this horrible blasted rows of it. I was like, it's all feeding in. Yeah, it's very warm up here.
Any other
follow on from this idea of the ambivalence of cocoa under shade, cocoa under sun, ambivalence we've mentioned about Anthony and all the is part of the problem with Selvin's short story and his novel that it is kind of, it doesn't have any of that environmental.
No, that's actually not the problem, because actually it's got it's got Obeya in it, it's got Manco who's doing it, and it's actually more just that it's more frustrating, I think, because the portrayal of Sarojini, the heroine, she's such a 2D, there's no characterization, she's just an exoticized, really hot Indo-Trinidadian woman that this, like, white dude wants. And, like, even though we're in college encouraged to be critical of white dude's perspective, Selvin doesn't give us the other side to counter it. You know, she's only flesh. So it's very problematic. And all the rituals, all the kind of food ways, even though she makes the cascadeau, she does it because Manco tells her to. It's all kind of masculinist priests who are kind of are holding the kind of authority in the culture. And I think there's something about the gender politics in that novel which are particularly frustrating and add a particular a kind of thinness to it. But it does have, you know, it has these moments where, you know, they're going in, they're performing these rituals, and it suddenly becomes real. You know, this is a reality. It's not just superstition. You know, so I do think there is those moments of, and also the sacral attached to the ecological. That moment, there is those moments there. I'm sorry, I didn't discuss any of this. I just didn't have time. But it's more the flatness of the general plot that I find really annoying and frustrating, and it's just very exoticizing. And there's also, like, there's lots of moments where it's kind of like a bit happy workers, happy working, look at us working, we like it, even though, like, oh look, the overseer sucks, and you know and it's hard to find food, and but it's still kind of like we're all full of joy and we're so pretty. Like, I'm sorry, I'm being horribly stereotyped, but there's a weird, it's a weird exoticism that goes throughout the book, which is trying to kind of mimic a colonialist attitude, but somehow doesn't completely refute it. That's my reading of it. Yeah. Maybe that's not fair, but
no, I think
it doesn't have that same thickness of peasant experience that you get from, you know, the Tiger novels or...
And it rebounds off Sheldon's essays as well, in that Ways of Sunlight to the story. It's 4 Day Mourning, which is the essay where he's talking about those kind of pastoral retreats at his auntie's house.
Yeah, it is very pastoral, and it's very, and it's also kind of like, oh, well, you know, this is the hill country. Things weren't violent here. The strikes are down in the capital. Sugarcane was horrible. But cocoa, you know, it's not so bad. You know, so I think there's a, and there is something to be said that perhaps the violence is much more extreme, but there is a kind of, I also think maybe the lack of thickness there has something to do with he knew, maybe, he can kind of materialize sugarcane in a way that he doesn't know cocoa. Like, I mean, I'm thinking of Merle Collins' brilliant line about Bernard Crode, who was one of the leaders of the revolution, and she's saying, the thing about Bernard, he don't know nutmeg on the ground. He doesn't know what it means to pick nutmeg. He doesn't know cocoa on the ground. He can tell you, give you a Marxist analysis of like of why the nutmeg co-op was exploitative, but he doesn't know the materiality of everyday experience. And she said, that's why I'm writing the novel, to narrate that. And I think there's something of that in Selvin. I'm not sure that's fair because I'm not a Selvin expert, but that's my sense of the novel. But it's still interesting that he chooses to write about it. So anyway, okay. Get away from this incredibly hot fan blowing hot air on me.
If there are no more questions, we should probably hit the coffee.
Badly needed stimulus. Sugar.